Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Inflation, rising interest rates, volatility. Whatever markets have in store, a financial advisor can help. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
The Explanation is the podcast from the BBC World Service that goes beyond the spin, exploring the important questions about long-running stories and the latest global news. An honest explanation of the events shaping our lives. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We're recording this at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 11th of October. Gaza's electricity goes off as the only power plant runs out of fuel. Israel continues its bombardment of the Palestinian territory and masses troops following the Hamas attacks at the weekend. In other news, Western Afghanistan's been hit by another strong earthquake, the second in days. Also in the podcast, NATO says it will take strong action if investigators find a gas pipeline in the Baltic was sabotaged. And
their designer, flat leather sandals, have had many nicknames over the years, but they've also managed to raise the hype around the brand with these partnerships.
The once uncool German Birkenstock brand that is now worth billions. Just before we began recording this podcast, we got news from Gaza that mains electricity had gone out there after the only power station in the Palestinian territory ran out of fuel. Israel has cut off electricity, fuel, water and food following the Hamas assault at the weekend. Airstrikes have continued with 1,055 people dead, according to Palestinian officials. Doctors have warned that hospitals could soon run out of supplies. Professor Hassan Abu Sita is a plastic and reconstructive surgeon usually based in London. He's been working in Gaza's main hospital over the past few days and he spoke to Martha Carney.
The hospital grounds have turned into a refugee camp. People are afraid, and so they're bringing their families to stay in the compound of the hospital as a safe space. And there's just a continuous stream of wounded. The hospital is at capacity beds, and most of the other hospitals already in Gaza are at capacity. Gaza has around 2,200 to 2,500 beds, and we've already had 4,500 wounded.
What kind of casualties have you been seeing?
So it's blast injuries, shrapnel injuries, masonry, fallen masonry, burns. And as is the case with all the wars in Gaza, there's such a high percentage of children that are wounded. I'm just about to go into the operating room with what looks like a 7 or 8 year old child with severe facial injuries. We have children with major burns. We have a teenager with 70% total body burns. And usually around the 30 to 40% of the wounded in Gaza's wars are children.
How are you managing to work as a doctor? We know the issues around supplies, around electricity, around water.
So the supplies are already running short because of the siege. I mean, this is 15 years of siege. And you feel it. You ask for basics, basic medication, and they're either very short or they're completely run out. And with regards to the electricity, the generators are on to at least keep the operating rooms running. But if this lasts for longer than the next few days, the health system is already on its knees and is unable to cope. And unless there's a humanitarian corridor to resupply the health system in Gaza, the health system is going to collapse.
Professor Hassan Abu Sita. And for the latest from Gaza, we heard from our reporter there, Rushdie Abu Alouf.
The shelling from tanks along the border to the western part of Gaza was intensified in the last half an hour or so. Also, we understand that Israeli Navy was engaged on firing into the seaport, the only harbor in Gaza, destroying most part of the of this harbor. The non-stop shelling since last night started around 8 o'clock in the evening last night with focusing the airstrikes in a neighborhood called Al-Karama in the north of Gaza. It's northwest of Gaza, where most of the damage overnight happened and where 30 people were killed. The overall death toll now is 1,055 people, and the number might be increased according to health ministry because there are many people who are in a very difficult, very severe injuries in the area. The health ministry just issued a statement saying that they will stop all of non-essential medical treatment plan. They will focus only on the life-saving treatment because they believe that by doing this, they can extend as much as possible the amount of fuel and the amount of medical staff, medical needs to help those people. Talking about the humanitarian situation, we are into the fifth day of this war and nothing is coming into Gaza. No, none from Egypt, none from Israel. Electricity supplies was cut off. Internet supplies also was cut off, and water supplies.
Rushdie Abu Alouf in Gaza. The total number of Israelis and foreign nationals killed in southern Israel has now reached 1,200 as sites of massacres are searched. Troops are massing near Gaza ahead of a possible invasion. The Israeli Defence Minister, Yoav Gallant, told soldiers the next phase of their offensive would come from the ground. He said Hamas wanted a change and it will get one. What was in Gaza will no longer be. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, interviewed Israeli Major General Itai Veruv, a commander of forces near the border. He asked him about the risk to Palestinian civilians.
We are not terrorists. We are soldiers and we are a Western country. And we know and we crush the Hamas and we kill them all. I hope so. But we will steal human beings until our last breath.
There's no sense in which you are suspending your obligations under the laws of war because of the extent of the emergency facing Israel?
We fight for our value and our culture all our life. And you know, you fought with value and you keep your value in the same time. And I know that we will be very aggressive and very strong, but we keep our moral and our value. We are Israeli, we are Jewish, and you know, war is a very difficult theater, a lot of problems. People that stay in the battlefield are suffer a lot. You can see what's happening here. But we come to kill an enemy, not a civilian in their bed.
Israeli Major General Itai Veruv. For more on the movements of Israeli troops, I spoke to our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, who is in southern Israel, just north of Gaza.
We're on the main road, which normally there would be a lot of traffic, but it is a closed military zone. There's been a lot more military vehicles racing by. There's more armor that's been massing in the fields around here. Some of it has been moving closer to the border. Just in my line of eyesight, when I look at the junction, where there's now only, there's flashing lights of police cars, there's Israeli flags, the blue and white Israeli flags, but also there's Israeli military vehicles and soldiers. Yeah, they're all coming out as a military center very close to here. All of this are the signs of preparation by Israel. It's very hard to say when they believe that they have enough forces here, enough armor, but also a plan. As we've been saying on the BBC that for decades, Israeli leaders, including Benjamin Netanyahu, have resisted this option. Going into Gaza, where Israeli troops pulled out in 2005, not wanting to risk the lives of soldiers, heading into a densely populated enclave where Hamas is no doubt prepared for this kind of an Israeli assault. It's fraught with risk, but given what has happened in the past several days, given the mood in Israel now, it seems that that is really the only option that's on the table. But it's a dangerous one.
Yeah, the military saying that following that shock attack on Saturday, they've now reinforced all communities in the area. I mean, does it feel safer now?
Well, I think nobody feels safe now, certainly not in Gaza, where we can see the plumes of black smoke rising just beyond the tree line. There's Bet Hanun, which is one of the Gaza towns inside the coastal strip. Even where we are, there's this big green sign here pointing to Zikim, which there's an umbrella and a beach. A place people used to go to spend some leisure time in this kibbutz. But there were some Hamas fighters which were able to infiltrate that kibbutz yesterday, even yesterday, a day after Israel said it had regained control of the south. But it has to admit, it cannot seal this border. It is very, very porous. Hamas is wanting to prove, it wants to be seen to prove that it can actually still come through. Now, you're probably hearing the traffic. White buses are going by. They're used to transport troops. And that's a flatbed military truck that's been bringing in supplies. Now, military vehicle, lights flashing. The side of the road is lined with vehicles next to military centers. Reservists who've been called up come to these areas, get out of their car, leave the car by the side of the road, pick up their gun and come down here to be part of the, for now, clearing this southern area and getting ready for the even bigger fight to come.
Lise Doucette in southern Israel. Meanwhile, EU officials have warned Elon Musk that his social media site X, formerly known as Twitter, is being used to spread false information about the conflict. EU Commissioner Thierry Breton wrote to Mr. Musk to say fake and manipulated images and facts were circulating on X. Mr. Musk said his firm had removed certain accounts. Mike Wendling is our US disinformation reporter.
Among plenty of legitimate reporting online, there's been a huge wave of fake news. Recycled videos from past conflicts, made-up headlines, footage from video games, and graphic propaganda. X is not alone among social networks in dealing with the deluge. But since taking over last year, Elon Musk dissolved an independent trust and safety council at the company, and he slashed jobs at its safety team. In a post on X, Elon Musk asked Mr. Breton to list the alleged illegal content and wrote, "Our policy is that everything is open source and transparent." Twitter's safety team says it's taken action on tens of thousands of more than 50 million posts about the conflict.
Mike Wendling, and as we record this podcast, we're just getting some news from southern Israel. A hospital there in the southern city of Ashkelon says it has been hit by a rocket fired from Gaza. Some other news now, and since the 1970s, the American musician Bernie Krause has made over 5,000 hours of sound recordings of wildlife habitats around the world. The archive provides a way of documenting shifts in endangered environments. He estimates that more than half of the habitats have fallen silent because of human activity. Bernie Krause spoke to Nicholas Stanbridge about a new collaboration bringing to life his archive from the Central African Republic.
Descending into darkness at 180 Studios in London with sounds from the Senga Forest in the Central African Republic, captured by Louis Sarno, produced by acoustic ecologist and author of the great animal orchestra, Bernie Krause.
We had Western lowland gorilla, African grey parrots, Haddada ibis, crater spotted monkey, and Guinea turaco.
All brought flickering to life with hovering, glowing lines of light, an installation designed by United Visual Artists, Matt Clark.
On the floor is an array of small discrete speakers, and that's where the sounds of crickets, frogs, birds call from. And then there's also an outer array of speakers where you get wind, chainsaws in the distance, planes flying overhead. And really it's an interplay between the man-made noises and forests. The structure is meant to represent a kind of monument to nature, which we can orchestrate like a sonic rewilding.
And as we hear the insects, you can see green lights. It's very soothing, very calming. As you hear the airplanes going over, they turn white. They become quite brittle to the eye, actually, to look at.
And really it sort of demonstrates, you know, we can live in harmony through the noise we make, but we can also disrupt nature.
Matt and his team have created an algorithm that allows you and the audience to see the sound and its effect.
Some of the recordings are the Bayaka tribe, who actually sort of make a lot of noise, music, but it's in harmony with the natural surroundings.
We learned orchestration, melody, rhythm, all of these things from the sounds of the natural world when we lived much more closely. So it's really an epic story of, you know, how these habitats are devastated by human endeavor. And the rainforest has been compromised because of extraction of hardwoods, habitats that no longer exist. The animals have been poached, like the elephants, for instance. That whole herd that I had in the original recording is gone now. In Louis' recordings, over time from 1984 to the time that he died, you can hear the sounds of the rainforest diminish.
Are you still traveling around and gathering sound?
Yes, I am, and I'm 85 years old. I was out last night. I'm recording here in Sonoma, which is north of San Francisco, the recordings of cricket sounds, night sounds, in an effort to record the entire year. Next comes the frogs after the rains, then the birds come back in the springtime.
Bernie Krause talking to Nicola Stanbridge. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
Of course it's going to end sometime, but everybody's in good fettle. There's no particular rush.
Ahead of the release of their new album, we hear from Rolling Stone Keith Richards.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
This is the story of one of fashion's dark secrets.
I was overwhelmed. Like, I had never seen anything like this.
At the height of Abercrombie & Fitch's success.
This was me being carefully manipulated.
Being lied to, tricked, and traded like a commodity.
Investigating allegations that would take me into a world of money, sex, and power. This is World of Secrets, Season 1, The Abercrombie Guys.
Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Afghanistan has been hit by a second powerful earthquake in a matter of days. The new 6.3 magnitude tremor struck early on Wednesday morning near the city of Herat. The extent of the damage isn't clear. Many people were already sleeping out in the open after their homes were destroyed in Saturday's quake. I got the latest from Dawood Azami from the BBC Afghan service.
The latest earthquake happened in the same region, which was hit on Saturday, 5 days ago. And since then, almost every day, people are saying that there are aftershocks. And today's aftershock was relatively stronger, and it happened early in the morning when many people were sleeping. And since then, since Saturday, many people don't live in their houses, in their bedrooms. They sleep outside in tents in the cold because they were scared that there might be another strong earthquake. So for this reason, we expect that there will be less casualties this time. But the earthquake and the aftershocks have killed around 2,000 people. I mean, there are different figures because the authorities and aid agencies still don't have a clear picture about the casualties. Definitely it's more than 1,000, and the Taliban government officials have been telling us that the death toll is around 2,500 and maybe more than that. But thousands of houses were damaged. Even this morning, many more houses were destroyed or damaged because most of the houses in that part of Afghanistan are made of mud bricks. They don't have resistance when there is an earthquake. And another point is that many people in that area are very poor. They rely on farming and livestock, and the earthquakes have killed much of their livestock as well. Aid has been arriving, but it is slow, and the Taliban government have been appealing from the international community and Afghan business persons to donate. But the UN agencies have been active there, and the Taliban government agencies are also operating. They have formed a special commission to help people, the survivors. And they have also pledged that they will build new houses for the people whose houses were destroyed.
Dawood Azami of the BBC Afghan service. Now, an update on a story we covered in our previous podcast, a possible attack on a major European gas pipeline. NATO has warned of a strong response if there is evidence that it was sabotaged. The Baltic Connector, running from Finland to Estonia, was shut down on Sunday after suddenly losing pressure. NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg spoke ahead of a meeting of defence ministers.
The important thing now is to establish what happened and how this could happen. If it is proven to be a deliberate attack on NATO critical infrastructure, then this will be, of course, serious, but it will also be met by a united and determined response from NATO.
Our Europe region editor, Danny Eberhard, gave us this update on the investigation.
The authorities tracked down where the leak has taken place, so that was the first thing. The Estonian defence minister has said significant force was used in damaging the pipeline, and he spoke about this mechanical impact or mechanical destruction. So I think investigators are looking at theories of either accidental damage, so perhaps something like a large ship's anchor coming down on the pipeline or being dragged in a storm and breaking it that way, or something deliberate. And the fear, obviously, is that it was something deliberate and sabotage. There is a Norwegian seismological institute that detected a seismic signal at a time that coincides with the events, and also in a location actually quite close to Nord Stream gas pipelines that cross it. It said that this could be a possible explosion, something less than 100 kilograms of TNT in explosive yield, so relatively small. But researchers there also say that it could be something, for example, like gas bursting out of a ruptured gas pipeline at pressure. So they're not saying it's an explosion. NATO is in touch with the authorities in both Finland and Estonia about their investigations and how to respond.
You mentioned Nord Stream, and this, of course, isn't the first time that an undersea pipeline has been damaged.
Yeah, the Nord Stream pipelines, which go from Russia to Germany, were severed in big explosions in September of last year. Three of four pipelines were damaged. Two were actually exporting gas at the time, and one was about to, or the Russians hoped it was about to open. But there is a difference. The signal that was detected in this incident was much smaller than the signals that were detected in the Nord Stream gas incidents, which were clearly explosive.
Our Europe region editor, Danny Eberhard. Now, it's been described as the world's ugliest shoe, but after a surge in popularity, the German sandal maker Birkenstock is making its debut on the New York Stock Exchange. In less than 3 years, the company has doubled in value and is now worth roughly $8.6 billion. It appears much of that success is down to a series of marketing deals. It even featured in the Barbie movie. But can Birkenstock maintain this momentum? Marguerite Leroland is a fashion analyst at Euromonitor International.
I think Birkenstock have a very good value proposition. They're a 250-year-old brand from Germany. They have this reputation of craftsmanship, know-how, and they're really famous for their design. The flat leather sandals have had many nicknames over the years, but they've also managed to raise the hype around the brand with these partnerships. You mentioned Barbie movie, but they've also had collections with Valentino, Dior, Jill Sanders, and many other designers. So they really managed to elevate the brand desirability. I think it's important for them to retain their identity, because consumers appreciate the consistency of their design, of their quality, and that's something key that the brand should retain in future. They will have to ensure that they strike these partnerships and collaborations regularly, as they've done in the past, but always finding an interesting designer or movie or celebrity to collaborate with. And it's great to build the brand hype, the engagement around the brand, to tell the story they want to tell.
Marguerite Leroland, fashion analyst at Euromonitor International. It is the Rolling Stones' first album of original songs in nearly two decades. Ahead of the release of Hackney Diamonds, guitarist Keith Richards, who is almost 80, has told the BBC he is ready to go back on the road. He's been speaking to our music correspondent, Mark Savage.
My job is to keep that rhythm thing going and to be a reliable part of the rhythm section. Solos come and go. Riffs last forever.
Your love affair with the guitar, that's kind of the defining thing about your career. But what's the fascination with it that keeps you coming back?
The fascinating thing about it is that the more you play it, the less you know it.
and I don't know if this is a sensitive question, but obviously you've struggled a little bit with arthritis in your fingers. Has that changed the way you play?
Funnily enough, I've no doubt it has, but it's not from, I don't have any pain. It's a sort of benign version, apparently. I think if I've slowed down a little bit, it's probably due more to age than to any particular thing. And also, I found that interesting. I said, well, I can't quite do that anymore, but the guitar will show me, well, there's another way of doing this. You know, some finger will go one space different and say, there's a whole new door just opened here. So we kept it as simple as possible, and he actually cut this record primarily to be a vinyl record, you know, with a cover and a plastic thing that you pull out and put on a turntable.
Do you still listen to vinyl? Is that how you prefer to play your music?
Far the best sound if you really want to listen to a record properly. I mean, digital is toy town, you know, synthesizers. Now you have AI, which is even more superficial and artificial. I hear the sweet,
sweet sounds of heaven. Sweet Sound of Heaven is one of the songs that's really going to stand out. It's a huge blues gospel song, and you've got Lady Gaga trading vocal hooks with Mick.
And also there's Stevie Wonder on there as well, which is sort of thing only happens when you record in LA. Guess who's dropped by? Lady Gaga is a piece of work. I love working with her because she has a great attitude towards things and a great voice. And I always wanted to see her play off against Mick.
There's so much energy to the music on this record. It feels like it's designed to play live. Have you got plans to take it out on the road?
Basically, yeah, that's the plot, is to next year take it on the road, and if everybody's still standing.
And I guess that brings me to the question that everybody asks you, but will this ever end? Will the Stones just keep going?
My answer is I'm not Nostradamus. Of course it's going to end sometime, but everybody's in good fettle. There's no particular rush. You know what I mean? Hell, we're having great fun doing this, you know, and this is what we do.
Keith Richards talking to Mark Savage. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Chris Lovelock and produced by Chantal Hartle. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Inflation, rising interest rates, volatility. Whatever markets have in store, a financial advisor can help. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.